From a quadruple Lutz now to the record for the most dogs jumping rope, 13. That's just one of the more than 50,000 feats chronicled in the latest print edition of Guinness World Records, released last month. In addition to those skipping dogs, there's also a new record for the longest tongue and the fastest wedding chapel. That would be a wedding chapel on wheels. Well, all this got NPR's Janae West wondering, what isn't a world record?
Actually, there are guidelines. You can't just think of any record and try to break it. Unless you're Homer Simpson.
I'm here to break a world record. What's the longest anyone's ever done this?
Three years.
Oh, fine. I'll just play the banjo with this cobra.
For the rest of us, Guinness World Records does not accept claims for perfect attendance, silent reading, elbow licking.
In reality, a lot of people can do it.
That's Mike Janella, head of the U.S. Records Management Team at Guinness. He says in general, the key to a potential new world record is that it must be
measurable, breakable, verifiable, and also interesting.
According to the guidelines, then, the organization won't accept massage marathon records because Guinness, quote, cannot visually judge style and form as to be correctly done for a long time. In other words,
after 2 or 3 hours, what does a massage become, really, except maybe just keeping your hands on someone's back?
Here's another no-go from Guinness.
Magic mirror on the wall. Who is the fairest one of all?
Beauty. Though that doesn't stop people from claiming to be the fairest. Truth be told, some of the alleged records rejected by Guinness are every bit as interesting as the ones they take. There was the man who claims to use mind control over sporting events, and another who swears he set the record for romantic brush-offs.
And every time he keeps asking her to try and actually set a date and a time and a place to go, she says she's busy and that she can't make it. And he applied to us saying it's been going on for more than a year, and he was wondering if that was a record for the longest time between asking someone out on a date and actually going on it.
On the flip side of all this is a guy like Ashrita Furman. He has the world record for, well, breaking the most world records. He currently holds more than 100 titles. One of his favorites
is racing for the fastest mile in a sack. And I did that in about 16 minutes and change. But I raced in Mongolia against a yak. Of course, I was in the sack, not the yak.
But Furman says even some of his submissions to Guinness have been denied, including one
for most salt shakers balanced on edge. So I submitted it, and they sent me back a notice saying, no, that's not something we're interested in.
So whatever the record, whether it's the most, the fastest, the highest, and whether or not it's accepted, there is one common thread. Again, here's Guinness World Records adjudicator Mike Janella.
The number one thing that connects everyone together is that you want to say, I can do this better than anybody else on this planet.
Perhaps the hardest part? Figuring out exactly what that is. Janae West, NPR News.
Anything you can do, I can do better. I can do anything better than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Anything you can be, I can be greater. Sooner or later, I'm greater than you.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. I can shoot a partridge with a single cartridge.
I can get a sparrow with a bow and arrow.
I can live on bread and cheese.
And only on that?
Yes.
So can a rat.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block. Now, an interview with Daniel Kahneman. He shared the Nobel Prize for Economics in 2002, although he's not an economist. Kahneman's field is the psychology of decision-making. And my co-host Robert Siegel spoke with him recently about his new book called Thinking Fast and Slow.
Daniel Kahneman, welcome to the program.
My pleasure to be here.
And let's start with the concept that's summed up in the title of your book, Thinking Fast and Slow. We have two ways of thinking, which you call System 1 and System 2. And I wonder if you can give us a good example of some fast System 1 thinking.
Well, one of my favorite examples is there is an upper-class British voice that says, I have large tattoos all down my back.
Large tattoos, yes.
Yes. And now, you know, people who speak with an upper-class British accent don't have large tattoos down their back. So the brain brings to bear all the world knowledge that's involved and register that there is an incongruity here. within, you know, between 3 and 4 tenths of a second. Mm. Or if a male voice says, I believe I'm pregnant, you will get an instant response, an incongruity. So those are instances of very fast thinking. And it's the same process of recognizing things and recognizing, distinguishing the familiar from the unfamiliar, coming up with solutions that have worked in the past. That's what's called, you know, expert intuition. All these are examples of fast thinking.
Fast system one thinking. Now enter system two, slower thinking.
System two, in the first place, I should make it clear that the systems don't really exist. It's a very convenient way of talking about them because it's easy for people to think of agents. And system one and system two do things. It's a kind of language that we fall into very naturally. System two is involved, we say, when people engage in orderly computations. So, you know, if I ask you to multiply 17 by 24, your system one is very likely to be quite silent. It's system two that has to compute this according to rules. And so system two deals with any kind of orderly reasoning. And also we attribute to system two the function of monitoring your thoughts and monitoring your actions and monitoring what you say. Obviously, we don't say everything that comes to mind, so there must be a function that inhibits things, and that is system two.
I think you're right at some point in the book that system two is who we like to think we are, actually.
Well, we mostly have access to system two. That is, we have access to our own reasoning self, to our own conscious self. Much of the interesting activity of that we call system one activity, much of that is completely unconscious, automatic, and very quick. That is, you know, you're surprised by something, but you don't really know what surprised you, or you recognize someone, but you don't really know what cues caused you to recognize that person. So system two, on the other hand, is typically conscious, deliberate, intentional, and that's who we think we are.
The great takeaway from your research in how we make decisions and how, our misplaced faith in expertise, for example, our overconfidence, it reminds me of the exchange between Robert Redford and Paul Newman in The Sting when they say, he's not as smart as he thinks he is, nor are we. We're not as much in control of our decision-making. We're much more imperfect than we might think.
Well, certainly. We're not in control because our preferences come from a lot of places that we don't know about. And second, there are really some characteristics of the way our mind works that are incompatible with perfect decision-making. In particular, we have a very narrow view of what is going on. And that narrow view, we take decisions as if that were the only decision that we're facing. We don't see very far in the future. We are very focused on one idea at a time, one problem at a time, and all these are incompatible with full rationality as economic theory assumes it.
There's one piece of research that you write about in the book that I'd like you to just mention, and that is, it's one that you cite to show that the phrase mental energy is not merely some metaphor. We expend energy by doing a lot of thinking, and it's the story of the Israel parole court, I guess, which turns down most applications for parole, but is remarkably more positive about cases that it takes up right after a meal break.
Yes, this was published in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences this year, and it's a very, very careful study of 8 parole judges in Israel and many, many cases. And as it happens, they keep an exact record of when they make each decision and also of when breaks are taken. Now, it turns out that there is a very large variability in the number, in the leniency, actually. I mean, the number of cases in which they award parole. And they're much more likely to do that immediately after a meal and much less likely to do that after a couple of hours and when presumably they're hungry. But certainly they're tired, they're depleted. And when you're depleted, when you're depleted, you tend to fall back on default actions. And the default action, apparently, in that case, is to deny parole. So, yes, so people are strongly influenced. They're influenced by the level of glucose in their brain. I mean, that's among other things.
So if you could get the clerk to say, I want you to look at this case right after lunch, your chances of parole might increase.
They do, quite significantly. Yes.
I mean, the implication of a study like that is here. Democratic society is based on people at all different levels making decisions. And if we assume that they're as driven by the glucose content of their bloodstream at that moment or other odd biases that they bring to factors, it undermines all the underpinning of a democratic society.
Well, you know, it doesn't undermine it in the sense that what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
I mean, you still need parole judges. They might, you know, one might think that with feedback and when they're informed of those things, they might be more careful. That is, they might be more careful when they're hungry and less prone to make quick default decisions. Clearly, the decision-making that we rely on in society is fallible.
Yeah.
And it's highly fallible, and we should know that.
Well, Daniel Kahneman, thank you very much for talking with us today.
It was my pleasure.
Daniel Kahneman is the author of the new book, Thinking, Fast and Slow.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block. 20-year-old figure skater Brandon Moroz has made history. He's the first skater to land a quadruple Lutz jump in a sanctioned competition. He executed that jump back on September 16th, and yesterday the International Skating Union officially recognized and confirmed it. Brandon Moroz joins me from the World Arena in Colorado Springs. Brandon, congratulations.
Thank you, thank you.
You know, I was watching that video. We have it up on our website, npr.org. You were skating to Mack the Knife. You make it look so easy. Were you nervous going into that quad?
I was a little bit. I've been doing it in training, and it's obviously relatively new. And so I don't know. There was just the unknown factor in trying it. But I don't know. I've always been a risk taker, so I was glad to try.
Did you know right away that you nailed it?
I did not, actually. Like, it kind of took me off by surprise. I hit it so perfectly, and I was just like, oh, man, I'm up. So...
Here's one thing I'm trying to figure out. Skaters have been landing quadruple jumps in competition going all the way back now to 1988, right? Toe loops and Salchows, but not the quadruple Lutz. Why is it harder?
I'd say it's harder, just different takeoff. I think the quad Lutz demands a little bit more. I've been doing quad toe for 3 years or more, and what makes the Lutz so tricky is that it's a backward takeoff. A lot of the other jumps, you're taking off forward, but the Lutz is taking off from a backward edge, and you're taking off backwards. So the Lutz is definitely a tricky jump, and I think that's why no one's really done it yet, and I'm probably one of the first to break history.
Brandon, there would be people listening to us talk about this who would say, you know, competitive figure skating is too much about jumps right now and not enough about aesthetics. Do you think they have a point?
That is a very good question. I think with skating, there's a lot of controversy about that. I think that it takes two. Skating is about the other stuff and, you know, about maybe the art. But I don't know. I think for guys skating that it is a little more athletic than the women's, because I think people watch, you know, female skaters and they're very, you know, pretty on the ice and it's more for the art. But I think for men, at least for me as a skater, I love the jumps and I love being an athlete, you know, doing tricks. So,
you know, Brandon, a while back it would have been that quadruple jumps were something that nobody could do. People do them all the time now. Do you imagine that pretty soon we'll be talking about quintuple jumps, that's coming?
There could be, maybe.
Yeah.
It's definitely a quintuple would be tough. I mean, I'm wicked fast at rotating, but I haven't got the. Maybe I should try one. Let you know.
Please, would you call me? Let me know.
But yeah, definitely. I don't know. It's interesting to see that a new quad's been done, and let alone by me, and, you know, for future generations to come, and how I can inspire, you know, new skaters, and I don't know, inspire maybe the sport to take another step, you know, push the sport a little.
Another leap.
Yeah, another leap. That's what it's all about. I'd love to leave like a little bit of a legacy and push the sport.
Well, Brandon, we'll be watching. Congratulations again.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your time.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block, and we begin this hour with some rare, encouraging news about the economy. Those dark fears about a double-dip recession seem to be overblown. New numbers from the government today show the U.S. economy grew at an okay pace, not great, but okay, during the third quarter. And the stock market is on a tear. The Dow closed up today around 3%. In fact, it's on track for the biggest monthly percentage gain since 1987. Some of the enthusiasm can be tied to signs of progress in Europe, but as NPR's Chris Arnold reports, there's also been a steady stream of more positive economic signals here in the U.S.
Up until recently, a lot of people were worried that the U.S. economy might be sliding backwards into another recession. But that's now looking much less likely. It turns out that the economy actually picked up some steam again over the summer. Consumers were out spending a little more money. Businesses did too. New numbers out today show that the U.S. gross domestic product grew at 2.5% from July through September.
2.5 certainly does signal there is no double dip. There's no second recession.
John Sylvia is the chief economist at Wells Fargo. He says when you dig into the report, one thing that's encouraging, Americans have been buying all kinds of products and services.
They're buying across the board. They did buy a lot of light trucks, but service spending was up, especially in the healthcare area. Non-durable goods were up as well. So the consumer spending was pretty broad-based, and that's another good sign that it's not just one thing that's moving this economy forward.
Another little talked-about indicator out this week actually comes from the trucking industry. Trucks in September were hauling around more products and supplies, up nearly 6% from a year ago.
Trucking, we are a good leading economic indicator for recessions, and we're just not showing it this time.
That's Bob Costello. He's the chief economist for the American Trucking Associations, and he tracks what's called the Truck Tonnage Index. That measures basically how much stuff trucks are moving around the country.
Things aren't great, but they're certainly not terrible. And in September, it was up nicely. We'll take it. But it's also important what it's not showing, and it's not showing that we're plunging into a recession either.
So looking ahead, the recovery will likely be slow moving, but John Sylvia is now predicting at least some more jobs for out-of-work Americans.
We'll probably have 9% unemployment through the winter, but I suspect by the spring we'll be breaking below the 9%, heading towards more like 8%. So 2012 looks like a little bit better year.
Also, inflation rose in this latest report to just a tenth of 1% above where the Federal Reserve wants to see it. John Sylvia says even when you factor out volatile energy and food prices, inflation appears to be around 2.1%.
So we do have inflation in the United States. It isn't roaring ahead inflation, but it is a little bit above the Fed's target, and it appears that right now, you do have this upward swing in terms of core inflation.
John Sylvia says that's probably not a big deal yet, but economists will be keeping an eye out for rising prices. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
American history is full of great inventors. Thomas Edison, Alexander Graham Bell, Steve Jobs toiling away in his garage. Well, this week brought the death of another great inventor. While the computer scientist and mathematician John McCarthy was not a household name, he is the reason you might have heard of a little something called artificial intelligence. He coined the term. Astrophysicist Adam Frank has these thoughts on McCarthy's legacy.
What is going to happen when our machines wake up? What will happen when all these computers which run our lives suddenly become intelligent and self-aware? It's a question which makes sense to ask this week as the world marks the passage of John McCarthy. McCarthy was a professor at Stanford known for pushing the boundaries of what was possible with machines. He developed the venerable computer language called Lisp and used it to create one of the first chess programs. He also helped spur the growth of the Internet through his early time-sharing technologies, which were like a version of cloud computing. But it's for AI that he will be remembered. artificial intelligence has become such a standard part of culture that I can refer to it by its initials, AI, and you know exactly what I'm talking about. But the possible consequences of developing an intelligent, self-aware machine are just as familiar. If I say robot overlords, you still know what I mean. There are basically two possibilities we naturally imagine when we think about AI. In the first, the development of machine intelligence brings us to a new age of wonders. We cure cancer, solve global warming, and design ships to carry us to the stars. It's a machine-human paradise. Think of the efficient, feminine voice of the computer on the Starship Enterprise, if you need an example. The other possibility, the robot overlord version, tends to get more play. We build machines, the machines wake up, the machines try to wipe us out. From the errant HAL in 2001, A Space Odyssey, to the machine masters of The Matrix or Battlestar Galactica, we have often given fictional form, or perhaps steel and plastic form, to our worst nightmares. Many AI researchers can see both possibilities hovering somewhere in the future. While some scientists admit it's difficult to imagine why a conscious, hyper-intelligent machine would want to continue doing our bidding, others think we will understand how to avoid that fate in the very process of building an intelligent machine. Some ambitious scientists even speak of a race to develop good AI rather than the bad kind. For these researchers, the dangers of getting it wrong make a catastrophe like the worst global warming look like a game of checkers. It's even possible that the intelligence from machines will be so different from our own that entirely new forms of cooperation or antagonism will come to pass. One thing is certain, though. For a culture that is ever more dependent on its devices, humanity will have to learn to share the world with its silicon children.
Astrophysicist Adam Frank is the author of About Time, Cosmology and Culture at the Twilight of the Big Bang.